This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1, RC40719, The Hidden City, The Tomilee, Book 3, by David Eddings. Copyright 1994 by David Eddings. All rights reserved. Read by Eric Sandvold. This book contains 457 pages on 13 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player in fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Library of Congress Annotation. Pandian knight Sparhawk won his battle with the evil god Sirgon, but now his wife, Queen Elana, has been kidnapped by Sirgon's evil followers. The price for getting her back is the powerful Belium Jewel. Sparhawk gathers his men together to again fight Sirgon. But this time, Sirgon has called upon a power normally forbidden to him, the Klel. Sequel to The Shining Ones, RC37334. Some violence and some strong language. Bestseller, 1994. From the book jacket, War to the Death. Battle had been joined, and fought, and won. The Pandian knight Sparhawk had met the forces of the foul god Sirgon upon the field of valor, and justice and might had carried the day. But even in Sparhawk's moment of triumph had come a crushing blow. For far away from the battlefield, Sirgon's hired minions had by treachery and stealth stolen away Sparhawk's very heart. They had kidnapped the beautiful Queen Elana, his wife. Sparhawk would have to surrender Belium, the awesome jewel of power, into their accursed hands, or Elana would die. Their goal had been to render Sparhawk impotent, but Sirgon's lackeys, in their craven, puny souls, had far misjudged that knight's unwavering resolve to fight on for his queen with every resource at his command. Aided by stalwart friends, Sparhawk charted a plan of attack, knowing that Elana's life hung in the balance. The road ahead promised peril for all those he held dear, but none of his companions flinched at the awesome task before them, even knowing that Sirgon had summoned up forces of evil from Tomilee's dark past, and from sick and fetid places beyond mere human ken. But the full magnitude of the danger before them was yet to be revealed, for in his towering hubris, Sirgon had dared that which was forbidden even to the gods. He had called forth Klel, Belium's opposite, a monster eager to rend the very world asunder. Ravening destruction stalked all the lands, for from before time began it was writ that Belium must contend with its opposite for the fate of this world. Even so must the man Sparhawk finally face the god Sirgon in mortal combat, and alone. Adventure in the realms of danger and of magic, among heroes and gods, and the fearsome, wondrous forces that shape destiny itself. In this shattering novel of ultimate confrontation, best-selling author David Eddings presents the towering conclusion to the Tomilee. About the author. David Eddings was born in Spokane, Washington in 1931, and was raised in the Puget Sound area north of Seattle. He received a Bachelor of Arts degree from Reed College in Portland, Oregon in 1954, and a Master of Arts degree from the University of Washington in 1961. He has served in the United States Army, worked as a buyer for the Boeing Company, has been a grocery clerk, and has taught college English. He has lived in many parts of the United States. His first novel, High Hunt, published by Putnam in 1973, was a contemporary adventure story. The field of fantasy has always been of interest to him, however, and he turned to the Belgariad in an effort to develop certain technical and philosophical ideas concerning the genre. Eddings and his wife Lee currently reside in the Southwest. Other books by David Eddings. The Belgariad. Book 1, Pawn of Prophecy. Book 2, Queen of Sorcery. Book 3, Magician's Gambit. Book 4, Castle of Wizardry. Book 5, Enchanter's Endgame. The Malorian. Book 1, Guardians of the West. Book 2, King of the Murghos. Book 3, Demon Lord of Karanda. Book 4, Sorceress of Garshiva. Book 5, The Seeress of Kel. The Elenium. Book 1, The Diamond Throne. Book 2, The Ruby Knight. Book 3, The Sapphire Rose. The Losers. The Tomoe. Book 1, Domes of Fire. Book 2, The Shining Ones. For Dr. Bruce Gray, for his enthusiasm and his technical advice, and for keeping our favorite author and wife alive. And for Nancy Gray, RN, who takes care of everybody else and neglects to take care of herself. Shape up, Nancy. Reader's note. Captions to maps found in the print edition are not included in this recording. End of reader's note. Prologue. Professor Itanya of the Foreign Affairs Department of the University of Mathurin sat on the platform reviewing his notes. It was early in the evening of a fine spring day, and the windows of the auditorium where the faculty of the College of Political Science had gathered were open to admit the smell of flowers and grass and the faintly distracting sound of birdsong. Professor Emeritus Gintana of the International Trade Department stood at the lectern, droning on interminably about 27th century tariff regulations. Gintana was a wispy, white-haired, and slightly vague academic, customarily referred to as that dear old man. Itanya was not really listening to him. This was not going to go well, he concluded wryly, crumpling up and discarding yet another sheet of notes. Word of his subject had been broadcast across the campus, and academics from as far away as applied mathematics and contemporary alchemy packed the hall, their eyes bright with anticipation. The entire faculty of the Contemporary History Department filled the front rows, their black academic robes making them look like a flock of crows. Contemporary history was here in force to ensure all the fireworks anyone could hope for. Itanya idly considered a feigned collapse. How, in the name of God, any God, was he going to get through the next hour without making a total ass of himself? He had all the facts, of course, but what rational man would believe the facts? A straightforward account of what had really happened during the recent turmoil would sound like the ravings of a lunatic. If he stuck to straight truth, the hacks from contemporary history would not have to say a word. He could destroy his own reputation with no help from them at all. Itanya took one more brief glance at his carefully prepared notes. Then he bleakly folded them and thrust them back into the voluminous sleeve of his academic robe. What was going to happen here tonight would more closely resemble a tavern brawl than reasoned discourse. Contemporary history had obviously showed up to shout him down. Itanya squared his shoulders. Well, if they wanted a fight, he'd give them one. A breeze had come up. The curtains at the tall windows rustled and billowed, and the golden tongues of flame flickering in the oil lamps wavered and danced. It was a beautiful spring evening, everywhere but inside this auditorium. There was a polite spattering of applause, and old Professor Gintana, flustered and confused by this acknowledgment of his existence, bowed awkwardly, clutched his notes in both hands, and tottered back to his seat. Then the Dean of the College of Political Science rose to announce the evening's main event. "Colleagues," he began, "before Professor Itanya favors us with his remarks, I would like to take this opportunity to introduce some visitors of note. I'm sure you will all join with me in welcoming Patriarch Emban, First Secretary of the Church of Kyrellos, Sir Bevier, the Cyrenic Knight from Archeum, and Sir Ulof of the Genidian Order located in Polesia." There was more polite applause as a pale, gawky student ushered the Elene visitors onto the stage, and Itanya hurried across the platform to greet his friends. "Thank God you're here," he said fervently. "The whole contemporary history department's turned out, except for the few who are probably outside boiling the tar and bringing up bags of feathers." "You didn't think your brother was going to hang you out to dry, did you, Itanya?" Emban smiled, settling onto a bench beneath the window. "He thought you might get lonesome here, so he sent us to keep you company. Vitania felt better as he returned to his seat. If nothing else, Bevier and Ulof could head off any physical attacks. And now, colleagues and distinguished guests, the dean continued, Professor Vitania of the Foreign Affairs Department will respond to a recent paper published by the Department of Contemporary History under the title The Sirga Affair, an examination of the recent crisis. Professor Vitania? Vitania rose, strode purposefully to the lectern, and assumed his most offensively civilized expression. Dean Altus, distinguished colleagues, faculty wives, honored guests. He paused. Did I leave anybody out? There was a titter of nervous laughter. Tension was high in the hall. I'm particularly pleased to see so many of our colleagues from contemporary history here with us this evening, Vitania continued, throwing the first punch. Since I'll be discussing something near and dear to their hearts, it's much better that they're present to hear what I say with their own ears, rather than being forced to rely on garbled second-hand accounts. He smiled benignly down at the scowling hacks in the front row. Can you hear me, gentlemen? He asked. Am I going too fast for any of you?
This is outrageous,
a portly, sweating professor protested loudly. It's going to get worse, Quinzel, Vitania told him. If the truth bothers you, you'd better leave now. He looked out over the assemblage. It's been said that the quest for truth is the noblest occupation of man. But there be dragons lurking in the dark forests of ignorance. And the names of these dragons are incompetence, and political bias, and deliberate distortion, and sheer wrong-headed stupidity. Our gallant friends here in contemporary history bravely sallied forth to do battle with these dragons in their recently published Sirga Affair. It is with the deepest regret that I must inform you that the dragons won. There was more laughter, and dark scowls from the front row. It's never been any secret at this institution that the Contemporary History Department is a political entity rather than an academic one, Vitania continued. It has been sponsored from its very inception by the Prime Minister, and its only reasons for existence have been to gloss over his blunders and to conceal, as best they might, his absolute incompetence. To be sure, Prime Minister Subat and his accomplice, Interior Minister Kolata, have never been interested in honesty. But please, gentlemen, this is a university. Shouldn't we at least pretend to be telling the truth? Rubbish, a burly academic in the front row bellowed. Yes, Vitania replied, holding up a yellow-bound copy of the Sirga Affair. But if you knew it was rubbish, Professor Passault, why did you publish it? The laughter in the hall was even louder this time, and it drowned out Passault's spluttered attempt to answer. Let us push on with this great work that we are in, Vitania suggested. We all know Pandya Subat for a scheming incompetent, but the thing that baffles me about your Sirga Affair is its consistent attempt to elevate the Styric renegade Zelasta to near sainthood. How in the name of God could anyone, even someone as severely limited as the Prime Minister, revere this scoundrel? How dare you speak so of the greatest man of this century? One of the hacks screamed at him. If Zelasta's the best this century can manage, colleague, I think we're in deep trouble. But we digress. The crisis which contemporary history chooses to call the Sirga Affair has been brewing for several years. Yes, someone shouted with heavy sarcasm. We noticed that. I'm so happy for you, Vitania murmured, drawing another loud laugh from the audience. To whom did our idiot Prime Minister turn for aid? To Zelasta, of course. And what was Zelasta's answer to the crisis? He urged us to send for the Pandya knight, Prince Sparhawk of Alenia. Why would the name of an Alene nobleman leap to Zelasta's lips in answer to the question, almost before it was asked? Particularly in view of the sorry record of the Alenes and their relations with the Styrics. To be sure, Prince Sparhawk's exploits are legendary. But what was it about the man that made Zelasta pine for his company? And why was it that Zelasta neglected to tell us that Sparhawk is Annika, the instrument of the Bellium? Did the fact somehow slip his mind? Did he think that the spirit which creates whole universes was somehow irrelevant? I find no mention at all about Bellium in this recently published heap of bird droppings. Did you omit the most momentous event of the past eon deliberately? Were you so caught up in trying to give your adored Pandya Subot credit for policy decisions he had no part in, that you decided not to mention Bellium at all?
Balderdash! A deep voice roared.
I'm pleased to meet you, Professor Balderdash. My name's Itanya. It was good of you to introduce yourself. Thanks awfully, old boy. The laughter was tumultuous this time.
Fast on his feet, isn't he?
Itanya heard Uloth murmur to Bevier. Itanya looked up. Colleagues, he said, I submit that it was not Prince Sparhawk that Zelasta so yearned for, but the Bellium. Bellium is the source of ultimate power, and Zelasta has been trying to get his hands on it for 3 centuries, for reasons too disgusting to mention. He has been willing to go to any lengths. He has betrayed his faith, his people, and his personal integrity, such as it was, to gain what the trolls call the Flower Gem.
That tears it, the corpulent Quinzel declared, rising to his feet. This man is mad. Now he's talking about trolls. This is an academic affair, Itanya, not the children's hour. You've picked the wrong forum for fairy tales and ghost stories. Why don't you let me do this, Itanya? Ulaf said, rising to his feet and coming to the podium. I can settle this question in just a moment or two.
Feel free, Itanya said gratefully. Ulaf set one huge hand on each side of the lectern.
Professor Itanya has requested me to brief you gentlemen on a few matters, he said. I take it that you're having some difficulties with the notion of trolls.
None at all, Sir Knight, Quinzel retorted. Trolls are an Aline myth, and nothing else. There's no difficulty in that at all.
What an amazing thing. I spent 5 years compiling a trollish grammar. Are you saying that I was wasting my time?
I think you're as mad as Itanya is.
Then you probably shouldn't irritate me, should you? Particularly in view of the fact that I'm so much bigger than you are.
Ulaf squinted at the ceiling.
Logic tells us that no one can prove a negative. Are you sure you wouldn't like to amend your statement?
No, Sir Ulaf. I'll stand by what I just said. There's no such thing as a troll.
Did you hear that, block of...
Ulaf raised his voice slightly.
This fellow says that you don't exist.
There was a hideous roar in the corridor outside the auditorium, and the double doors at the rear splintered and crashed inward.
Stay calm, Bevier hissed as Itanya jumped. It's an illusion. Ulaf's amusing himself.
Would you like to turn around and tell me what you see at the back of the hall, Quinzel?
Ulaf asked.
Exactly what would you call my friend Blockoff there?
The creature hulking in the doorway was huge, and its bestial face was contorted with rage. It stretched its paws forth hungrily.
Who has said this, Ulaf?
It demanded in a hideous voice.
I will cause hurt to it. I will rip it to pieces and eat it.
Can that troll actually speak Tamil? Itanya whispered. Of course not, Bevier smiled. Ulaf's getting carried away. The hideous apparition in the doorway bellowed a horribly graphic description of its plans for the faculty of the Contemporary History Department.
Were there any other questions about trolls?
Ulaf asked mildly, but none of the assembled academics heard him over all the shouts, screams, and the tipping over of chairs. It took the better part of a quarter of an hour to restore order once Ulaf had dismissed his illusion, and when Itanya reapproached the lectern, the entire audience was huddled closely together near the front of the auditorium. I'm touched by your eagerness to hear my every word, gentlemen, Itanya smiled.
But I can speak loudly enough to be heard at the back of the hall, so you needn't draw so close. I trust that the visit of Sir Olaf's friend has cleared up the little misunderstanding about trolls. He looked at Quinzel, who was still cowering on the floor, gibbering in terror. Splendid, Titania said. Briefly, then, Prince Sparhawk came to Tomalee. The Leans are sometimes a devious people, so Sparhawk's wife, Queen Elana, proposed a state visit to Mathurin and concealed her husband and his friends in her entourage. Upon their arrival, they almost immediately uncovered some facts which we had somehow overlooked. First, Emperor Sarabian actually has a mind, and second, the government led by Pandya Subat was in league with our enemies. Treason! A thin, balding professor shrieked, leaping to his feet. Really, Dalish? Itania asked. Against whom? Why, Dalish floundered. You still don't understand, do you, gentlemen? Itania asked the Faculty of Contemporary History. The previous government has been overthrown by the Emperor himself. Tomalee is now an Aline-style monarchy, and Emperor Sarabian rules by decree. The previous government and its prime minister are no longer relevant. The prime minister cannot be removed from office, Dalish screamed. He holds his position for life. Even if that were true, it suggests a rather simple solution to the problem, doesn't it? You wouldn't dare. Not me, old boy. That's the emperor's decision. Don't cross him, gentlemen. If you do, he'll decorate the city gates with your heads. But let's press on here. I'd like to cover a bit more ground before our customary recess. It was the abortive coup attempt that finally brought things to a head. Pandya Subat was a party to the entire conspiracy, and he fully intended to stand around wringing his hands while the drunken mob murdered all of his political enemies, evidently including the emperor himself. If Professor Dalish wants to scream treason, he might take a look at that. We discovered much in the aftermath of that failed coup, not only concerning the treason of the Prime Minister, but of the Minister of the Interior as well. Most important, however, was the discovery that it had been Zalasta who had engineered the entire plot, and that he was secretly allied with Akatis, High Priest of Sirgon, the god of the supposedly extinct Sirgai. At this point, Prince Sparhawk had no choice but to retrieve Belium from its hiding place and to send to Kyrellos for reinforcements. He enlisted other allies as well, not the least of which were the Delphae, who do in fact exist in all their glowing horror.
This is absurd,
Contemporary History's reigning bully boy, the crude and muscular Professor Pasault, sneered.
Are we supposed to believe this nonsense?
You've already seen a troll this evening, Pasault, Itania reminded him. Would you like a personal visitation by a shining one as well? I can arrange it if you'd like, but outside, please. We'd never get rid of the stink if you were dissolved into a puddle of slime right here in front of the platform. Dean Altus cleared his throat meaningfully. Yes, sir, Itania assured him. I'll just be a few more minutes. He turned back to the audience. Now then, he continued quickly, since the subject of the trolls has come up again, we might as well clear it away once and for all. As you've noticed, the trolls are real. They were lured to Tomalee from their home range in northern Silesia by Sirgon, who posed as one of their gods. The real troll gods have been imprisoned for eons, and Prince Sparhawk offered them an exchange, their freedom in return for their aid. He then led a sizable force to northern Aton, where the misguided trolls had been stirring up turmoil in hopes of forcing the Atons to return to defend their homeland, which would have left us effectively defenseless, since the Atons comprised the bulk of our army. Sparhawk's move seemed to play right into the hands of our enemies, but when Sirgon and Zalasta unleashed the trolls, Sparhawk called forth their gods to reclaim them. In desperation, Sirgon reached back in time and produced a huge army of his Sirgai, and the trolls, true to their nature, ate them. You don't really expect us to swallow this, do you, Itanya?
Professor Sarafon, chairman of the Department of Contemporary History and brother-in-law of the Prime Minister, demanded scornfully.
Was that supposed to be a pun, Sarafon? Itanya asked. No matter. The short answer is that you might as well, Itanya told him. Your wife's brother isn't dictating official history anymore. From now on, the Emperor wants us to give our students the plain, unvarnished truth. I'll be publishing a factual account in the next month or so. You'd better reserve a copy, Sarafon, because you're going to be required to teach it to all your students in the future, assuming that you have a future at this institution. Next year's budget's going to be a little tight, I understand, so a number of departments will probably have to be dropped. He paused. Are you any good with tools, Sarafon? There's a very nice little vocational school at Jura, I hear. You'd just love Daconia.
The dean cleared his throat again, a bit more urgently this time.
Sorry, Dean Altus, Itanya apologized. I'm running past time, gentlemen, so I'll just briefly sum up one more development. Despite their crushing defeat, Sirgon and Zelasta were by no means powerless. In a bold stroke, Zelasta's natural son, one Scarpa, crept into the Imperial compound and abducted Queen Elana, leaving behind a demand that Sparhawk give up the Bellium in exchange for the safe return of his wife. Following the recess Dean Altus has been so patiently awaiting, I will take up Prince Sparhawk's reaction to that development.
Part 1. Barrett. Chapter 1. A chill haze was rising from the meadow, and thin clouds had drifted in from the west to obscure the cold, brittle sky. There were no shadows, and the frozen ground was iron-hard and unyielding. Winter was inexorably tightening its grip on the North Cape. Sparhawk's army, girt in steel and leather and thousands strong, was lined up along a broad front in the frost-covered grass of the meadow near the ruins of Tezada. Sir Barrett sat his horse in the center of the bulky armored church knights, watching the ghastly feast taking place a few hundred yards to the front. Barrett was a young and idealistic knight, and he was having some difficulty with the behavior of their new allies. The screams were remote, mere rumors of agony, and those who were screaming were not actually people. Not really. They were no more than shades, the scarce-remembered reflections of long-dead men. Besides, they were enemies, members of a cruel and savage race that worshipped an unspeakable god. But they steamed. That was the part of the horror Sir Barrett could not shrug off. Though he told himself that these Sirgai were dead, phantoms raised by Sirgon's magic, the fact that steam rose from their eviscerated bodies as the ravening trolls fed on them brought all of Barrett's defenses crashing down around his ears. Trouble? Sparhawk asked sympathetically. Sparhawk's black armor was frost-touched, and his battered face was bleak. Barrett felt a sudden embarrassment. It's nothing, Sir Sparhawk. He lied quickly. It's just... He groped for a word. I know. I'm stumbling over that part myself. The trolls aren't being deliberately cruel, you know. To them, we're just food. They're only following their nature.
That's part of the problem, Sparhawk. The notion of being eaten makes my blood run cold.
Would it help if I said, better them than us?
Not very much. Barrett laughed weakly. Maybe I'm not cut out for this kind of work. Everybody else seems to be taking it in stride.
Nobody's taking it in stride, Barrett. We all feel the same way about what's happening. Try to hold on. We've met these armies out of the past before. As soon as the trolls kill the Sirgai generals, the rest should vanish, and that'll put an end to it.
Sparhawk frowned.
Let's go find Ulaf, he suggested. I just thought of something, and I want to ask him about it.
All right, Barrett agreed quickly.
The two black-armored Pandians turned their horses and rode through the frosty grass along the front of the massed army. They found Ulaf, Tinian, and Bevier 100 yards or so down the line.
I've got a question for you, Ulas, Sparhawk said as he reined Farron in.
For me? Oh, Sparhawk, you shouldn't have.
Ulas removed his conical helmet and absently polished the glossy black ogre horns on the sleeve of his green surcoat.
What's the problem?
Every time we've come up against these antiques before, the dead all shriveled up after we killed the leaders. How are the trolls going to react to that?
How should I know?
You're supposed to be the expert on trolls.
Be reasonable, Sparhawk. It's never happened before. Nobody can predict what's going to happen in a totally new situation.
Make a guess, Sparhawk snapped irritably. The two of them glared at each other.
Why badger Ulath about it, Sparhawk? Bevier suggested gently. Why not just warn the troll gods that it's going to happen and let them deal with the problem?
Sparhawk rubbed reflectively at the side of his face, his hand making a kind of sandy sound on his unshaven cheek.
Sorry, Ulath, he apologized. The noise from the banquet hall out there is distracting me. I know just how you feel, Ulath replied wryly. I'm glad you brought it up, though. The trolls won't be satisfied with dried rations when there's all this fresh meat no more than a quarter mile away.
He put his ogre-horned helmet back on.
The troll gods will honor their commitment to Afriel, but I think we'd better warn them about this. I definitely want them to have a firm grip on their trolls when supper turns stale. I'd hate to end up being the dessert course.
Elana, Sophrenia gasped. Keep your voice down, Afriel muttered.
She looked around. They were some distance to the rear of the army, but they were not alone. She reached out and touched Kyle's bowed white neck, and Sophrenia's palfrey obediently ambled off a little way from Carlton and Zanisha to crop at the frozen grass.
I can't get too many details, the child goddess said. Melodir's been badly hurt, and Nirtai's so enraged that they've had to chain her up. Who did it? I don't know, Sophrenia. Nobody's talking to Danae. All I can get is the word hostage. Somebody's managed to get into the castle, seize Elana and Aileen, and spirit them out. Saradian's beside himself. He flooded the halls with guards, so Danae can't get out of her room to find out what's really happening. We must tell Sparhawk. Absolutely not. Sparhawk bursts into flames when Elana's in danger. He's got to get his army safely back to Metherion before we can let him catch on fire. But no, Sophrenia. He'll find out soon enough. But let's get everyone to safety before he does. We've only got a week or so left until the sun goes down permanently and everything and everyone up here turns to solid ice. You're probably right, Sophrenia conceded.
She thought a moment, staring off at the frost-silvered forest beyond the meadow.
That word, hostage, explains everything, I think. Is there any way you can pinpoint your mother's exact location?
Afriel shook her head.
Not without putting her in danger. If I start moving around and poking my nose into things, Sirgon will feel me nudging at the edges of his scheme, and he might do something to Mother before he stops to think. Our main concern right now is keeping Sparhawk from going crazy when he finds out what's happened.
She suddenly gasped, and her dark eyes went very wide.
What is it? Sophrenia asked in alarm. What's happening? I don't know, Afriel cried. It's something monstrous.
She cast her eyes about wildly for a moment, and then steadied herself, her pale brow furrowing in concentration. Then her eyes narrowed in anger.
Somebody's using one of the forbidden spells, Sophrenia, she said in a voice that was as hard as the frozen ground. Are you sure? Absolutely. The very air stinks of it.
Geryon the Necromancer was a cadaverous-looking styric with sunken eyes, a thin, almost skeletal frame, and a stale, mildewed odor about him. Like the other styric captives, he was in chains and under the close watch of church knights well-versed in countering styric spells. A cold, oppressive twilight was settling over the encampment near the ruins of Tezada when Sparhawk and the others finally got around to questioning the prisoners. The troll gods had taken their creatures firmly in hand when the feeding orgy had come suddenly to an end, and the trolls were now gathered around a huge bonfire several miles out in the meadow, holding what appeared to be religious observances of some sort.
"Just go through the motions, Bevier," Sparhawk quietly advised the olive-skinned Cyrenic knight as Geryon was dragged before them. "Keep asking him irrelevant questions until Zanisha signals that she's picked him clean."
Bevier nodded. "I can drag it out for as long as you want, Sparhawk. Let's get started."
Sir Bevier's gleaming white surcoat, made ruddy by the flickering firelight, gave him a decidedly ecclesiastical appearance, and he prefaced his interrogation with a lengthy prayer. Then he got down to business. Geryon replied to the questions tersely in a hollow voice that seemed almost to come echoing up out of a vault. Bevier appeared to take no note of the prisoner's sullen behavior. His whole manner seemed excessively correct, even fussy, and he heightened that impression by wearing fingerless wool gloves such as scribes and scholars wear in cold weather. He doubled back frequently, rephrasing questions he had previously asked, and then triumphantly pointing out inconsistencies in the prisoner's replies. The one exception to Geryon's terse brevity was a sudden outburst of vituperation, a lengthy denunciation of Zelasta and Sirgon for abandoning him here on this inhospitable field.
"Bevier sounds exactly like a lawyer," Carlton muttered quietly to Sparhawk. "I hate lawyers."
"He's doing it on purpose," Sparhawk replied. "Lawyers like to spring trick questions on people, and Geryon knows it. Bevier's forcing him to think very hard about the things he's supposed to conceal, and that's all Zanisha really needs. We always seem to underestimate Bevier."
"It's all that praying," Carlton said sagely. "It's hard to take a man seriously when he's praying all the time."
"We're knights of the church, Carlton, members of religious orders."
"What's that got to do with it?"
"In his own mind, he is more dead than alive,"
Zanisha reported later, when they had gathered around one of the large fires the Aetons had built to hold back the bitter chill. The Anarae's face reflected the glow of the fire, as did her unbleached wool robe.
"Were we right?" Tinian asked her. "Is Sirgon augmenting Geryon's spells so that he can raise whole armies?"
"He is," she replied.
"Was that outburst against Zelasta genuine?" Vanyan asked her.
"Indeed, my lord. Geryon and his fellows are increasingly discontent with the leadership of Zelasta. They have all come to expect no true comradeship from their leader. There is no longer common cause among them, and each doth seek to wring best advantage to himself from their dubious alliance. Overlaying all is the secret desire of each to gain sole possession of Velium."
"Dissension among your enemies is always good," Vanyan noted, "but I don't think we should discount the possibility that they'll all fall in line again after what happened here today. Could you get anything specific about what they might try next, Anarae?"
"Nay, Lord Vanyan, they were in no wise prepared for what has come to pass. One thing did stand out in the mind of this Geryon, however, and it doth perhaps pose some danger. The outcasts who surround Zelasta do all fear Sazada of Issos, for he alone is versed in Zemach magic, and he alone doth plunge his hand through that door to the netherworld which Azash opened. Horrors beyond imagining lie within his reach. It is Geryon's thought that since all their plans have thus far gone awry, Sirgon, in desperation, might command Sazada to use his unspeakable art to raise creatures of darkness to confront and confound us."
Vanyan nodded gravely.
"How did Stragan's plan affect them?" Talon asked curiously.
"They are discomfited out of all measure," Zanisha replied. "They did rely heavily on those who are now dead."
"Stragan will be happy to hear that. What were they going to do with all those spies and informers?"
"Since they had no force capable of facing the Aetons, Zelasta and his cohorts thought to use the hidden employees of the Ministry of the Interior to assassinate diverse Tamil officials in the subject kingdoms of the Empire, hoping thereby to disrupt the government."
"You might want to make a note of that, Sparhawk," Carlton said.
"Oh?"
"Emperor Sarabian had some qualms when he approved Stragan's plan. He'll probably feel much better when he finds out that all Stragan really did was beat our enemies to the well." They'd have killed our people if Stragan hadn't killed theirs first.
That's very shaky moral ground, Carlton, Bevier said disapprovingly.
I know, Carlton admitted. That's why you have to run across the top of it so fast.
The sky was overcast the following morning. Thick, roiling clouds steamed in from the west, all seas and confusion. Because it was late autumn and they were far to the north, it seemed almost that the sun was rising in the south, turning the sky above Bellion's escarpment a fiery orange, and reaching out feebly with ruddy, low-lying light to paint the surging underbellies of the swift-scudding cloud with a blush of flame. The campfires seemed wan and weak, and very tiny against the overpowering chill here on the roof of the world, and the knights and their friends all wore fur cloaks and huddled close to the fires. There were low rumbles off to the south, and flickers of pale, ghastly light.
Thunder? Carlton asked Ulof incredulously. Isn't it the wrong time of the year for thunderstorms?
It happens.
Ulof shrugged.
I was in a thunderstorm north of Hyde once that touched off a blizzard. That's a very unusual sort of experience.
Whose turn is it to do the cooking?
Carlton asked him absently.
Yours,
Ulof replied promptly.
You're not paying attention, Carlton.
Tinian laughed.
You know better than to ask that question.
Carlton grumbled and started to stir up the fire.
I think we'd better get back to the coast today, Sparhawk, Vanyan said gravely. The weather's held off so far, but I don't think we'll be able to count on that much longer.
Sparhawk nodded. The thunder grew louder, and the fire-red clouds overhead blanched with shuddering flickers of lightning. Then there was a sudden rhythmic booming sound.
Is it another earthquake?
Kring cried out in alarm.
No, Khalad replied. It's too regular. It sounds almost like somebody beating a very big drum.
He stared at the top of Bellium's wall.
What's that?
He asked, pointing. It was like a hilltop rearing up out of the forest beyond the knife-like edge of the top of the cliff. Very much like a hilltop, except that it was moving. The sun was behind it, so they could not see any details. But as it rose higher and higher, they could make out the fact that it was a kind of flattened dome with two pointed protuberances flaring out from either side like huge wings. And still it swelled upward. As they could see more of it, they realized that it was not a dome. It seemed to be some enormous inverted triangle instead, wide at the top, pointed at the bottom, and with those odd wing-like protuberances jutting out from its sides. The pointed bottom seemed to be set in some massive column. Since the light was behind it, it was as black as night, and it rose and swelled like some vast darkness. Then it stopped, and then its eyes opened. Like two thin, fiery gashes at first, the blazing eyes opened wider and wider, cruelly slanted like cat's eyes, and all ablaze with fire more incandescent than the sun itself. The imagination shuddered back from the realization of the enormity of the thing. What had appeared to be huge wings were the creature's ears. And then it opened its mouth and roared, and they knew that what they had heard before had not been thunder. It roared again, and its fangs were flickers of lightning that dripped flame like blood.
Clow!
Aphriel shrieked. And then, like two rounded, bulky mountains, the shoulders rose above the sharp line of the cliff, and fanning out from the shoulders like black sails, two jointed bat-like wings.
What is it?
Talon cried.
It's Clell!
Aphriel shrieked again.
What's a Clell?
Not what, you dolt! Who? Izash and the other elder gods cast him out. Some idiot has returned him.
The enormity atop the escarpment continued to rise, revealing vast arms with many-fingered hands. The trunk was huge, and flashes of lightning seethed beneath its skin, illuminating ghastly details with their surging flickers. And then that monstrous presence rose to its full height, towering 80, 100 feet above the top of the escarpment. Sparhawk's spirit shriveled. How could they possibly...
Blue Rose,
he said sharply.
Do something.
There is no need, Annika.
Vanyan's usurped voice was very calm as Belium once again spoke through his lips.
Clell hath but momentarily escaped Sirgon's grasp. Sirgon will not risk his creature in a direct confrontation with me.
That thing belongs to Sirgon?
For the moment. In time that will change, and Sirgon will belong to Clell.
What is it doing? Betwana cried. The monstrosity atop the cliff had raised one huge fist and was striking at the ground with incandescent fire, hammering at the earth with lightning. The face of the escarpment shuddered and began to crack away, falling, tumbling, roaring down to smash into the forest at the foot of the cliff. More and more of the sheer face crumbled and sheared away and fell in a huge, thundering landslide.
Clell was never uncertain of the strength of his wings, Belium observed calmly. He would come to join battle with me, but he fears the height of the wall. Thus he prepares a stair for himself.
Then, with a booming like that of the earthquake which had spawned it, a mile or more of the escarpment toppled ponderously outward and crashed into the forest, piling rubble higher and higher against the foot of the cliff. The enormous being continued to savage the top of the cliff, spilling more and more rubble down to form a steep causeway reaching up and up to the top of the wall. And then the thing called Clell vanished, and a shrieking wind swept the face of the escarpment, whipping away the boiling clouds of dust the landslide had raised. There was another sound as well. Sparhawk turned quickly. The trolls had fallen to their faces, moaning in terror.
We've always known about him, Afriel said pensively. We used to frighten ourselves by telling stories about him. There's a certain private pleasure in making one's own flesh crawl. I don't think I ever really admitted to myself that he actually existed. Exactly what is he?
Bevier asked her.
Evil.
She shrugged.
We're supposed to be the essence of good. At least, that's what we tell ourselves. Clell is the opposite. He's our way of explaining the existence of evil. If we didn't have Clell, we'd have to accept the responsibility for evil ourselves, and we're a little too fond of ourselves to do that. Then this Clell is the king of hell? Bevier asked. Well, sort of. Hell isn't a place, though. It's a state of mind. The story has it that when the elder gods, Azash and the others, emerged, they found Clell already here. They wanted the world for themselves, and he was in their way. After several of them had tried individually to get rid of him and got themselves obliterated, they banded together and cast him out. Where did he come from? Originally, I mean, Bevier pressed.
Bevier was very much caught up in first causes.
How in the world should I know? I wasn't there. Ask Belium.
I'm not so much interested in where this Clell came from as I am in what kinds of things it can do, Sparhawk said.
He took Belium out of the pouch at his waist.
Blue Rose, he said, I do think we must talk concerning Clell.
It might be well, Annika,
the jewel responded, once again taking control of Vanyan.
Where did he, or it, originate?
Clell did not originate, Annika. Even as I, Clell hath always been.
What is it? He.
Necessary. I would not offend thee, Annika, but the necessity of Clell is beyond thine ability to comprehend. The child goddess hath explained Clell sufficiently within her capabilities.
Well, really, Afriel spluttered.
A faint smile touched Vanyan's lips.
Be not wroth with me, Afriel. I do love thee still, despite thy limitations. Thou art young, and age shall bring thee wisdom and understanding.
This is not going well, Blue Rose, Sophronia warned the stone.
Ah, well, Belium sighed. Let us then to work. Clell was, in fact, cast out by the elder gods, as Afriel hath told thee.
although the spirit of Clell, even as my spirit, doth linger in the very rocks of this world, as in all others which I have made. Moreover, what the elder gods could do, they could also undo, and the spell which hath returned Clell was implicit in the spell which did cast Clell out. Clearly, some mortal conversant with the spells of the elder gods hath reversed the spell of casting out, and Clell hath returned.
Can he, or it, be destroyed?
It is not he of which we speak, nor do we speak of some it. We speak of Clell. But nay, Annika, Clell cannot be destroyed, no more than can I. Clell is eternal.
Sparhawk's heart sank. I think we're in trouble, he muttered to his friends.
The fault is in some measure mine. So caught up was I in the birth of this latest child of mine that mine attention did stray from needful duties. It is my wont to cast Clell out at a certain point in the making of a new world. This particular child did so delight me, however, that I delayed the casting out. Then it was that I did encounter the red dust which did imprison me, and the duty to cast Clell out did devolve upon the elder gods. The casting out was made imperfect by reason of their imperfection, and thus it was possible for Clell to be returned.
By Sirgon? Sparhawk asked bleakly.
The spell of casting out and returning is spirit. Sirgon could not utter it.
Suzata, then, Sophronia guessed. He might very well have known the spell. I don't think he'd have used it willingly, though.
Sirgon probably forced him to use it, little mother, Carlton said. Things haven't been going very well for Sirgon and Zalasta lately.
But to call Clell,
Afriel shuddered.
Desperate people do desperate things,
Carlton shrugged.
So do desperate gods, I suppose.
What do we do, Blue Rose? Sparhawk asked. About Clell, I mean to say.
Thou canst do nothing, Annika. Thou didst well when thou didst meet Azash, and doubtless will do well again in thy dispute with Sirgon. Thou wouldst be powerless against Clell, however.
We're doomed, then.
Sparhawk suddenly felt totally crushed.
Doomed? Of course thou art not doomed. Why art thou so easily downcast and made disconsolate, my friend? I did not make thee to confront Clell. That is my duty. Clell will trouble us in some measure, as is Clell's wont. Then, as is our custom, Clell and I will meet.
And thou wilt once more banish him?
That is never certain, Annika. I do assure thee, however, that I will strive to mine utmost to cast Clell out, even as Clell will strive to cast me out. The contest between us doth lie in the future, and, as I have oft told thee, the future is concealed. I will approach the contest with confidence, however, for doubt doth weaken resolve, and timorous uncertainty doth weigh down the spirit. Battle should be joined with a light heart and joyous demeanor.
You can be very sententious sometimes, Worldmaker, Afriel said, with just a hint of spitefulness.
Be nice, Belium chided mildly.
Annika!
It was Gwarg, the god of Kill. The huge presence came across the frosty meadow, plowing a dark path through the silver-sheathed grass.
I will hear the words of Gwarg, Sparhawk replied.
Have you summoned Clell? Is it your thought that Clell will aid us in causing hurt to Sirgon? It is not good if you have. Let Clell go back.
It was not my doing, Gwarg. Neither was it the Flower Gem's doing. It is our thought that it was Sirgon who summoned Clell to cause hurt to us.
Can the Flower Gem cause hurt to Clell?
That is not certain. The might of Clell is even as the might of the Flower Gem.
The god of Kell squatted on the frozen turf, scratching at his shaggy face with one huge paw.
"Sirgon is as nothing, Annika," he rumbled in an almost colloquial form of speech. "We can cause hurt to Sirgon tomorrow, or sometime by and by. We must cause hurt to Klel now. We cannot wait for by and by."
Sparhawk dropped to one knee on the frozen turf. "Your words are wise, Gworg." Gworg's lips pulled back in a hideous approximation of a grin.
"The word you use is not common among us, Annika. If Quadge said, 'Gworg is wise,' I would cause hurt to him."
"I did not say it to cause you anger, Gworg."
"You are not a troll, Annika. You do not know our ways. We must cause hurt to Klel so that he will go away. How can we do this?"
"We cannot cause hurt to him. Only the flower gem can make him go away."
Gworg smashed his fist against the frozen ground with a hideous snarl. Sparhawk held up one hand.
"Sirgon has called Klel," he said. "Klel has joined Sirgon to cause hurt to us. Let us cause hurt to Sirgon now, not by and by. If we cause hurt to Sirgon, he will fear to aid Klel when the flower gem goes to cause hurt to Klel and make him go away."
Gworg puzzled his way through that.
"Your words are good, Annika," he said finally. "How might we best cause hurt to Sirgon now?"
Sparhawk considered it.
"The mind of Sirgon is not like your mind, Gworg, nor is it like mine. Our minds are direct. Sirgon's is guileful. He threw your children against our friends here in the Lands of Winter to make us come here to fight them. But your children were not his main force. Sirgon's main force will come from the Lands of the Sun to attack our friends in the City that Shines."
"I have seen that place. The child goddess spoke first with us there."
Sparhawk frowned, trying to remember the details of Vanyan's map.
"There are high places here and to the south," he said.
Gworg nodded.
"Then, even farther south, the high places grow low, and then they become flat."
"I see it," Gworg said. "You describe it well, Annika."
That startled Sparhawk. Evidently, Gworg could visualize the entire continent.
"In the middle of that flat place is another high place that the Man-Things call the Tommel Mountains."
Gworg nodded in agreement.
"The main force of Sirgon's children will pass that high place to reach the City that Shines. The high place will be cool, so your children will not suffer from the sun there."
"I see which way your thought goes, Annika," Gworg said. "We will take our children to that high place and wait there for Sirgon's children. Our children will not eat Afriel's children. They will eat Sirgon's children instead."
"That will cause hurt to Sirgon and his servants, Gworg."
"Then we will do it."
Gworg turned and pointed toward the landslide.
"Our children will climb Klel's stairway. Then Gnome will make time stop. Our children will be in the high place before the sun goes to sleep this night."
He stood up abruptly.
"Good hunting," he growled,
turned, and went back to join his fellows and the still terrified trolls.
"We have to proceed as if things were normal," Vanyan told them as they gathered near the fire a couple of hours past noon.
The sun, Sparhawk noted, was already going down.
"Klel can probably appear at any time and any place. We can't plan for him any more than we can plan for a blizzard or a hurricane. If you can't plan for something, about the only thing you can do is take a few precautions and then ignore it."
"Well spoken," Queen Betwana approved.
Betwana and Vanyan were getting along well.
"What do we do then, friend Vanyan?" Takumi asked.
"We're soldiers, friend Takumi," Vanyan replied. "We do what soldiers do. We get ready to fight armies, not gods. Scarpa's coming up out of the jungles of Arjuna,
and I'd expect another thrust to come out of Sineska. The trolls will probably hamper Scarpa, but they can only move out a short way from those mountains in southern Tommel proper because of the climate. After the initial shock of encountering trolls, Scarpa will probably try to go around them.
Venion consulted his map.
We'll have to have forces in place to respond either to Scarpa or to an army coming out of Sineska. I'd say that Samar would be the best location.
Sarna, Betwana disagreed.
Both, Ulof countered. Forces in Samar could cover everything from the southern edge of the Aton Mountains to the Sea of Arjuna, and be in position to strike eastward to the southern Tamil Mountains if Scarpa evades the trolls. Forces in Sarna could block the invasion route through the Aton Mountains.
His point's well taken, Bevier said. It divides our forces, but we don't have much choice.
We could put the knights and the Paloi in Samar, and the Aton infantry in Sarna, Tinian added. The lower valley of the river Sarna is ideal for mounted operations, and the mountains around Sarna itself are natural for Aetons.
Both positions are defensive, Engessa objected. Wars aren't won from defensive positions.
Sparhawk and Vanyan exchanged a long look.
Invade Sineska? Sparhawk asked dubiously.
Not yet, Venion decided. Let's wait until the church knights get here from Eosia before we do that. When Comier and the others cross into Sineska from the west, that's when we want to come at the place from the east. We'll put Sirgan in a vice. With that sort of force coming at him from both sides, he can raise every Seer guy who's ever lived, and he'll still lose.
Right up until the moment he unleashes Krell, Afriel added moodily.
No, Divine One, Sparhawk told her. Belium wants Sirgan to send Klel against us. If we do it this way, we'll force the issue in a place and time that we choose. We'll pick the spot Sirgan will unleash Klel, and I'll unleash Belium. Then all we have to do is sit back and watch.
We'll go to the top of the wall the same way the trolls went, Vanyan Preceptor. Engessa said the following morning. We can climb as well as they can.
It might take us a little longer, Takumi added. We'll have to push boulders out of the way to get our horses up that slope.
We will help you, Takumi Domi, Engessa promised.
That's it, then, Tinian summed up. The Aetons and the Paloi will go south from here to take up positions in Sarna and Samar. We'll take the knights back to the coast, and Sorgai will ferry us back to Mithyrium. We'll go overland from there.
It's the ferrying that concerns me, Sparhawk said. Sorgai is going to have to make at least a half dozen trips.
Khalad sighed and rolled his eyes upward.
I gather you're going to embarrass me in public again, Sparhawk said. What am I overlooking?
The rafts, Sparhawk,
Khalad said in a weary voice.
Our guy's gathering up the rafts to take them south to the timber markets. He's going to lash them all together into a long log boom. Put the knights in the ships, the horses on the boom, and we can all make it to Mithyrian in one trip.
I forgot about the rafts, Sparhawk admitted sheepishly. That log boom won't move very fast,
Ulof pointed out. Zenisha had been listening to their plans intently. She looked at Khalad and spoke diffidently, almost shyly.
Might a steady wind behind the logs assist thee, young master?
Zenisha asked Khalad.
It would indeed, Anare, Khalad said enthusiastically. We can weave rough sails out of tree limbs.
Won't Sirgan or Klel feel you raising a breeze, dear sister?
Sophrenia asked.
Sirgan cannot detect Delphaic magic, Sophrenia,
Zenisha replied.
Annika can ask Belium whether Klel is similarly unaware.
How did you manage that?
Afriel asked curiously. Zenisha looked slightly embarrassed.
It was to hide from thee and thy kindred, divine Afriel. When Edamus did curse us, he did so arrange his curse that our magic would be hidden from our enemies. For thus did we view thee at that time. Doth that offend thee, Divine One? Not under these circumstances, Anaray, Flute replied, warming up into Zanisha's arms and kissing her soundly. Chapter 2. The log boom Captain Sorgai's sailors had constructed from the rafts was a quarter of a mile long and 100 feet wide. Most of it was taken up by the huge corral. It wallowed and wobbled its way south under threatening skies, and it was frequently raked by stinging sleet squalls. The weather was bitterly cold, and the young knights who manned the raft were bundled to the ears in furs and spent most of their time huddled in the dubious shelter of the flapping tents.
"It's all in attention to detail, Barrett,"
Khalad said as he tied off the rope holding the starboard end of one of their makeshift sails in place.
"That's all that work really is. Details."
He squinted along the ice-covered line of what was really much more like a snow fence than a sail.
"Sparhawk looks at the grand plan and leaves the details to others. It's a good thing, really, because he's a hopeless incompetent when it comes to little things and real work."
"Khalad!" Barrett was actually shocked.
"Have you ever seen him try to use tools? That was something our father used to tell us over and over. Don't ever let Sparhawk pick up a tool. Calton's fairly good with his hands, but Sparhawk's hopeless. If you hand him anything associated with honest work, he'll hurt himself with it."
Khalad's head came up sharply, and he swore.
"What's wrong?
Didn't you feel it? The port side tow ropes just went slack. Let's go wake up those sailors. We don't want this big cow turning broadside on us again."
The two fur-clad young men started across the icy collection of lashed-together rafts, skirting the huge corral where the horses huddled together in the bitterly cold breeze coming from astern. The idea of making a log boom out of the raft was very good in theory, but the problems of steering proved to be far more complex than either Sorgai or Khalad had anticipated. Khalad's thickly woven fences of evergreen boughs acted well enough as sails, moving the sheer deadweight of the boom steadily southward ahead of Zanisha's breeze. But Sorgai's ships were supposed to provide steerage way by towing the boom, and that was where the problems cropped up. No two ships ever move at exactly the same rate of speed, even when propelled by the same wind. Thus, the 50 ships ahead and the 25 strung out along each side of the boom had to be almost constantly fine-tuned to keep the huge raft moving in the right general direction. As long as everybody paid very close attention, all went well. 2 days south of Bellium's Wall, however, a number of things had gone wrong all at once, and the log boom had swung around sideways. No amount of effort had been able to straighten it out, and so they had been obliged to take it apart and reassemble it. Back-breaking labor in the bitter cold. Nobody wanted to go through that again. When they reached the port side of the boom, Barrett took a dented brass horn out from under his fur cape and blew a flat, off-key blast at the port side towboats, while Khalad picked up a yellow flag and began to wave it vigorously. The prearranged signals were simple. The yellow flag told the ships to crowd on more sail to keep the towing hawsers taut. The blue flag told them to put out the sea anchors to slack off on the ropes. And the red flag told them to cast off all lines and get out of the way. The tow ropes went tight again as Khalad's crisp signal trickled down through the ranks to the sailors who actually did the work aboard the ships.
"How do you keep track of everything?" Barrett asked his friend. "And how do you know so quickly that something's wrong?"
"Pain," Khalad replied wryly. "I don't really want to spend several days taking this beast apart and putting it back together again with the spray freezing on me. So I'm paying very close attention to the things my body's telling me. You can feel things change in your legs and the soles of your feet. When one of the hawsers goes slack, it changes the feel of how the boom moves."
"Is there anything you don't know how to do?"
"I don't dance very well."
Khalad squinted up into the first stinging pellets of another sleet squall.
"It's time to feed and water the horses," he said. "Let's go tell the novices to stop sitting around admiring their titles and get to work."
"You really dislike the aristocracy, don't you?"
Barrett asked as they started forward along the edge of the corral toward the wind-whipped tents of the apprentice knights.
"No, I don't dislike them. I just don't have any patience with them, and I can't understand how they can be so blind to what's going on around them. A title must be a very heavy thing to carry if the weight makes you ignore everything else.
You're going to be a knight yourself, you know.
It wasn't my idea. Sparhawk gets silly sometimes. He thinks that making knights of my brothers and me is a way of honoring our father. I'm sure that father's laughing at him right now.
They reached the tents, and Khalad raised his voice.
All right, gentlemen, he shouted. It's time to feed and water the animals. Let's get at it.
Then he critically surveyed the corral. 5,000 horses leave a great deal of evidence that they have been present.
I think it's time for another lesson in the virtue of humility for our novices, he said quietly to Barrett.
Then he raised his voice again.
And after you've finished with that, you'd better break out the scoop shovels and wheelbarrows again. We wouldn't want to let the work pile up on us, would we, gentlemen?
Barrett was not yet fully adept at some of the subtler forms of magic. That part of the Pandian training was the study of a lifetime. He was far enough along, however, to recognize tampering when he encountered it. The log boom seemed to be lumbering southward at a crawl, but the turning of the seasons was giving some things away. It should have taken them much longer to escape the bitter cold of the far north, for one thing, and the days should not have become so much longer in such a short time, for another. However it was managed, and whoever managed it, they arrived at a sandy beach a few miles north of Mithyrian late one golden autumn afternoon, long before they should have, and began wading the horses ashore from the wobbly collection of rafts.
Short trip,
Khalad observed laconically, as the two watched the novices unloading the horses. You noticed, Barrett laughed.
They weren't particularly subtle about it. When the spray stopped freezing in my beard between 1 minute and the next, I started having suspicions.
He paused.
Is magic very hard to learn? He asked.
The magic itself isn't too hard. The hard part is learning the Styric language. Styric doesn't have any regular verbs. They're all irregular, and there are 9 tenses.
Barrett, please speak plain Alenic.
You know what a verb is, don't you?
Sort of. But what's a tense?
Somehow that made Barrett feel better. Khalad did not know everything. We'll work on it, he assured his friend. Maybe Sophrenia can make some suggestions. The sun was going down in a blaze of color when they rode through the opalescent gates into fire-domed Mithyrian, and it was dusk when they reached the imperial compound.
What's wrong with everybody?
Khalad muttered as they rode through the gate. I didn't follow that, Barrett confessed.
Use your eyes, man. Those gate guards were looking at Sparhawk as if they expected him to explode, or maybe turn into a dragon. Something's going on, Barrett.
The main body of church knights rode off across the twilight-dim lawn to their barracks, while the rest of the party clattered across the drawbridge into Aelana's castle. They dismounted in the torchlit courtyard and trooped inside.
It's even worse here, Khalad murmured. Let's stay close to Sparhawk in case we have to restrain him. The knights at the drawbridge seemed to be actually afraid of him.
They went up the stairs to the royal apartment. Mirtai was not in her customary place at the door, and that made Barrett even more edgy. Khalad was right. Something here was definitely not the way it should be. Emperor Sarabian, dressed in his favorite purple doublet and hose, was nervously pacing the blue-carpeted floor of the sitting room as they entered, and he seemed to shrink back as Sparhawk and Vanyan approached him.
Your Majesty, Sparhawk greeted him, inclining his head. It's good to see you again.
He looked around.
Where's Aelana?
He asked, laying his helmet on the table.
In a minute, Sparhawk. How did things go on the North Cape?
More or less the way we'd planned. Sirgon doesn't command the trolls anymore. But we've got another problem that might be even worse.
Oh?
We'll tell you about it when Aelana joins us. It's not such a pretty story that we'd want to go through it twice.
The Emperor gave Foreign Minister Oscania a helpless look.
Let's go speak with Baroness Melodir, Prince Sparhawk, Oscania suggested. something's happened here. She was present, so she'll be able to answer your questions better than we would.
All right.
Sparhawk's gaze was level, and his voice was steady, despite the fact that Sarabian's nervousness and Oscania's evasive answer fairly screamed out the fact that something was terribly wrong. Baroness Melodir sat propped up in her bed. She wore a fetching blue dressing gown, but the sizable bandage on her left shoulder was a clear indication that something serious had happened. Her face was pale, but her eyes were cool and rock steady. Stragan sat at her bedside in his white satin doublet, his face filled with concern.
Well, Melodir said, finally.
Her voice was crisp and businesslike. She flicked a withering glance at the Emperor and his advisors.
I see that these brave gentlemen have decided to let me tell you about what happened here, Prince Sparhawk. I'll try to be brief. One night a couple of weeks ago, the Queen, Aileen, and I were getting ready for bed. There was a knock on the door, and four men we thought were Poloi came in. Their heads were shaved, and they wore Poloi clothing, but they weren't Poloi. One of them was Krager. The other three were Elron, Baron Perak, and Scarpa.
Sparhawk did not move, and his face did not change expression. And? He asked, his voice still unemotional.
You've decided to be sensible, I see, Melodir said coolly. Good. We exchanged a few insults, and then Scarpa told Elron to kill me, just to prove to the Queen that he was serious. Elron lunged at me, and I deflected his thrust with my wrist. I fell down and smeared the blood around to make it appear that I'd been killed. Ilana threw herself over me, pretending to be hysterical, but she'd seen what I'd done.
The Baroness took a ruby ring out from under her pillow.
This is for you, Prince Sparhawk. Your wife hid it in my bodice. She also said, tell Sparhawk that I'm all right, and tell him that I forbid him to give up Bellium, no matter what they threaten to do to me. Those were her exact words. Then she covered me with a blanket.
Sparhawk took the ring and slipped it onto his finger.
I see, he said in a calm voice. What happened then, Baroness?
Scarpa told your wife that he and his friends were taking her and Aileen as hostages. He said that you were so foolishly attached to her that you'd give him anything for her safe return. He obviously intends to exchange her for the Bellium. Krager had a note already prepared. He cut off a lock of Ilana's hair to include in the note. I gather that there'll be other notes, and each one will have some of her hair in it to prove that it's authentic. Then they took Ilana and Aileen and left.
Thank you, Baroness,
Sparhawk said, his voice still steady.
You've shown amazing courage in this unfortunate business. May I have the note?
Melodir reached under her pillow again, took out a folded and sealed piece of parchment, and handed it to him. Barrett had loved his queen from the moment he had first seen her sitting on her throne encased in crystal, although he had never mentioned the fact to her. There would be other loves in his life, of course, but she would always be the first. So it was that when Sparhawk broke the seal, unfolded the parchment, and gently removed the thick lock of pale blonde hair, Barrett's mind suddenly filled with flames. His grip tightened around the haft of his war axe. Khalad took him by the arm, and Barrett was dimly startled by just how strong his friend's grip was.
That's not going to do anybody any good at all, Barrett, he said in a crisp voice. Now why don't you just give me the axe before you do something foolish with it?
Barrett drew in a deep, trembling breath, pushing away his sudden, irrational fury. Sorry, Khalad, he said. I sort of lost my grip there for a moment. I'll be all right now. He looked at his friend. Sparhawk's going to let you kill Krager, isn't he?
So he says.
Would you like some help? Khalad flashed him a quick grin.
It's always nice to have company when you're doing something that takes several days, he said.
Sparhawk quickly read the note, his free hand still gently holding the lock of Ilana's pale hair. Barrett could see the muscles rippling along his friend's jaw as he read. He handed the note to Vanyan.
You'd better read this to them, he said bleakly.
Vanyan nodded and took the note. He cleared his throat.
Well now, Sparhawk, he read aloud, I gather that your temper tantrum's over.
I hope you didn't kill too many of the people who were supposed to be guarding your wife. The situation here is painfully obvious, I'm afraid. We've taken Elana hostage. You will behave yourself, won't you, old boy? The tiresomely obvious part of all this is that you can have her back in exchange for Bellium and the rings. We'll give you a few days to rant and rave and try to find some way out of this. Then, when you come to your senses and realize that you have no choice but to do exactly as you're told, I'll drop you another note with some rather precise instructions. Do be a good boy and follow the instructions to the letter. I'd really rather not be forced to kill your wife, so don't try to be creative. Be well, Sparhawk, and keep an eye out for my next note. You'll know it's from me, because I'll decorate it with another lock of Elana's hair. Pay very close attention, because if our correspondence continues for too long, your wife will run out of hair, and I'll have to start using fingers. And it's signed Krager, Vanyan concluded. Colton smashed his fist into the wall, his face rigid with fury. That's enough of that, Vanyan snapped.
What are we going to do? Colton demanded.
We have to do something. We're not going to jump 8 feet into the air and come down running, for a start, Vanyan told him.
Where's Mirtai? Kling's voice had a note of sudden alarm.
She's perfectly all right, Domi, Sarabian assured him. She was a little upset when she found out what happened.
A little? Oskanya murmured. It took 12 men to subdue her. She's in her room, Domi Kring. Chained to the bed, actually. There are some guards there as well to keep her from doing herself any injury.
Kling abruptly turned and left Melodir's bedroom. We're tiring you, aren't we, Baroness? Arabian said then.
Not in the least, Your Majesty, she replied in a cool voice.
She looked around at them.
It's a bit cramped in here. Why don't we adjourn to the sitting room? I'd imagine we'll be most of the night at this, so we might as well be comfortable.
She threw back her blankets and started to get out of bed. Stragan gently restrained her. Then he picked her up.
I can walk, Stragan, she protested.
Not while I'm around, you can't.
Stragan's customary expression of civilized urbanity was gone as he looked around at the others, and it had been replaced with one of cold, tightly suppressed rage.
One thing, gentlemen, he told them. When we catch up with these people, Elrond's mine. I'll be very put out with anybody who accidentally kills him.
Baroness Melodir's eyes were quite content, and there was a faint smile on her face as she laid her head on Stragan's shoulder. Calador was waiting for them in the sitting room. His knees and elbows were muddy, and there were cobwebs in his hair.
I found it, Your Majesty, he reported to the Emperor. It comes out in the basement of that barracks the Church Knights have been using.
He looked appraisingly at Sparhawk.
I'd heard you were back, he said. We've managed to pick up a little information for you.
I appreciate that, Calador, Sparhawk replied quietly.
The big Pandian's almost inhuman calm had them all more than a little on edge.
Stragan was a bit distracted after what happened to the Baroness here, Calador reported, so I was left more or less to my own devices. I took some fairly direct steps. The ideas were all mine, so don't blame him for them.
You don't have to do that, Calador,
Stragan said, carefully tucking a blanket around Melodir's shoulders.
You didn't do anything I didn't approve of. I take it that there were a few atrocities.
Ulof surmised. Let me start at the beginning, Calador said, brushing his hands through his hair, trying to dislodge the cobwebs. One of the men we'd been planning to kill during the Harvest Festival managed to evade my cutthroats, and he sent me a message offering to exchange information for his life. I agreed to that, and he told me something I didn't know about. We knew that there were tunnels under the lawns here in the Imperial compound, but what we didn't know is that the ground under the whole city is honeycombed with more tunnels. That's how Krager and his friends got into the Imperial grounds, and that's how they took the Queen and her maid out.
Prithee, good Master Calador, stay a moment,
Zenisha said.
I have seen into the memories of the Minister of the Interior, and he had no knowledge of such tunnels.
That wouldn't be hard to explain, Anaray, Patriarch Amban told her.
Ambitious underlings quite often conceal things from their superiors. Teovin, director of the secret police, probably had his eye on Colata's position.
That's most likely it, Your Grace, Calador agreed. Anyway, my informant knew the location of some of the tunnels, and I put men down there to look around for more while I questioned various members of the secret police who were in custody. My methods were fairly direct, and the ones who survived the questioning were more than happy to cooperate. The tunnels were very busy on the night the Queen was abducted. The diplomats who were forted up in the Semescan embassy knew about the scheme, and they realized that we'd kick down their walls as soon as we found out that the Queen was gone. They tried to escape through the tunnels, but I already had men down in those rat holes. There were a number of noisy encounters, and we either rounded up or killed just about the entire embassy staff. The ambassador himself survived, and I let him watch while I interrogated several undersecretaries. I'm very fond of Queen Elana, so I was quite firm with them. He looked at Sophronia. I don't think I need to go into too much detail, he added.
Thank you, Sophronia murmured.
The ambassador didn't really know all that much, Calador continued apologetically, but he did tell me that Scarpa and his friends were going south from here, which may or may not have been a ruse. His Majesty ordered the ports of Mycy and Sarant sealed, and he put Aton patrols on the road from Tosa to the coast, just to be on the safe side. Nothing's turned up yet, so Scarpa either got way ahead of us, or he's gone down a hole someplace nearby.
The door opened, and Kring rejoined them, his face gloomy. Did you unchain her? Tinian asked him.
That wouldn't be a good idea right now, friend Tinian. She feels personally responsible for the Queen's abduction. She wants to kill herself. I took everything with any kind of sharp edge out of the room, but I don't think it's really safe to unshackle her just yet.
Did you get that spoon of hers away from her? Talon asked.
Kring's eyes went wide.
Oh, God! He exclaimed, bolting for the door.
If he'd only yell at us or bang his fist against the wall or something,
Barrett murmured to Khalad the next morning when they gathered once again in the blue-draped sitting room.
All he does is sit there.
Sparhawk keeps his feelings to himself,
Khalad replied.
It's his wife we're talking about, Khalad. He sits there like a lump. Doesn't he have any feelings at all?
Of course he does, but he's not going to take them out and wave them around for us to look at. Right now, it's more important for him to think than to feel. He's listening and putting things together. He's saving up his feelings for when he gets his hands on Scarpa.
Sparhawk sat in his chair with his daughter in his lap. He seemed to be studying the floor, and he was absently stroking Princess Danae's cat. Lord Vanyan was telling the Emperor and the others about Clell and about their strategic disposition of forces. The trolls to the Tommel Mountains in south-central Tommel proper, the Aetons to Sarna, and Takumi's Paloi to Samar. Fleet was sitting quietly on Sophronia's lap. Barret noticed something that hadn't occurred to him before. He glanced first at Princess Danae, and then at the child goddess. They appeared to be about the same age, and their bearing and manner seemed very much alike for some reason. The presence of the child goddess was having a peculiar effect on Emperor Sarabian. The brilliant, erratic ruler of the continent seemed dumbfounded by her presence, and he sat gazing wide-eyed at her. His face was pale, and he was obviously not hearing a word Lord Vanyan was saying. Afriel finally twisted around and returned his gaze. Then she slowly crossed her eyes at him. The Emperor stared back violently.
"Didn't your mother ever tell you that it's not polite to stare, Sarabian?" she asked him. "Mind your manners," Sophronia chided. "He's supposed to be listening. If I want adoration, I'll get myself a puppy."
End of Side 1. To continue, turn the cassette over.